Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 661. But now let's go to the Nerdist Community Cardboard. Our friend, who's been on At Midnight a bunch, Denver comic Adam Caton Holland, who is hilarious, has a new album out called Backyards. You can get it now on iTunes or on Amazon. Charlie Hoehn, I think it might be Hain. It's H-O-E-H-N. Charlie, I'm sorry I butchered your last name. He has a book out called Play It Away, A Workaholic's Cure for Anxiety by Charlie Hoehn. And he says, it's based on the viral blog post I wrote, How I Cured My Anxiety. It's been the number one result on Google for cure anxiety for the last 2 years. And it's been helping college kids who suffer from burnout, anxiety, severe depression. He's working at military bases around the country. And I have not personally read the book yet. But, if you could pick even one thing up from it to help with anxiety, I would say it's worth it. Or even if it just distracts you from anxiety as you read it. But it seems very promising, so pick it up on Amazon right now. Thank you, Charlie. You're doing very good work there, helping folks with the anxiety and the panics. Now, listener Claire, she did not give a last name, has created a group called Nerdist Scouts. She says it started as an art project that turned into an interactive group that I am the proud den mother of. Much like traditional scouting, members can earn merit badges for learning new skills that will help them in their favorite fantasy world. And her goal for Nerd Scouts is to have it grow into a worldwide community. So go to nerdscoutshq.com and see what it's all about. Get some type of merit badge. Why don't you? A bunch more shows coming up on the Fun Comfortable Tour. I'm in Minneapolis right now. Those shows were super fun, and we went to a place called Glam Doll Donuts afterwards and did a meet and greet there so the venue wouldn't have to stay open until 2 in the morning. But we got donuts and took the donuts are amazing. If you're in Minneapolis, go to Glam Doll. Got to see a bunch of people, and April Richardson and I had we had donuts for dinner. We had an amazing time, so thank you. More dates are coming. Madison, Wisconsin is tonight. That show is sold out. A bunch more shows are selling out on the road. So go to funcomfortabletour.com to get all the info on that as well. This episode is Adam Carolla. I don't know why I have to do it that way. I mean, it doesn't even really sound like him, but that's my that is the extent of my impression skills, at least with Adam. This is the fifth time Adam's been on. Adam and I have known each other since 1995. Oh, man. Those are like old people years, and you're like, I've been friends with this guy for 20 years. We were both adults then. We're adults now. But he has a new movie out called Road Hard, which is about a comic's life on the road and trying to maintain a relationship. And it is shockingly accurate, a lot of the bits about being on the road. It's also funny. So go to roadhardmovie.com, which is available on iTunes and Amazon as well. And but right now, here's the Nerdist Podcast number 661. I have to say, Adam is, when I first started podcasting, I'd been putting it off for a couple years because I thought, oh, I got to produce a show. It's got to be a big deal. And then when Adam left radio and started his podcast and I went and did it, I was like, oh, yeah, I could just talk to people like human beings. So it was going on Adam's, the first week of his podcast was very inspiring for me to start the Nerdist Podcast. So that's exactly what we're going to do now. We're going to start the Nerdist Podcast. Katie, start the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to the pod. I actually did see the movie. Oh my God! I'm the reason I said that is because it's a never ending chore in this town getting anyone to watch your anything. And I look for the dynamic, like the psychodynamic behind everything, because I keep thinking, why is it so hard to get people to watch an 87 minute comedy?
Yeah,
especially when most of them are in comedy.
Yeah.
And I've come to the conclusion that they think it's going to suck. And they would rather not see it and go, oh man, I've been on the road, or like I've been really slammed, but I'm going to watch it this weekend, then watch it, have it suck, and then have to kind of look down at their shoes
right
when they talk to you.
No, I watched it and it was great. And it was chilling in a lot of ways, because the portrayal of life on the road is shockingly accurate. I mean, to a level of, I don't know if most people who are not on the road, I mean, I think they would enjoy it just because, like, oh, it's just these kind of bummer things that happen on the road. But having been on the road for a long time, it especially at a time when I remember not being able to, like, fill a room. Oh, it's just, just because everything about it just reminds you, like, you're not doing well. You know, like, people treat you like, they basically treat you like hey, get up there and dance around so we can sell chicken nuggets.
Yeah. Oh, fingers, but yeah. Or chicken tenders, as we figure out in the movie.
Chicken tenders.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't feel like there's any, like, real road comedy movies. There's like a lot of stand-up specials, and then like a lot of more stylized stuff, or a lot of like Sally Fields as a housewife and Eddie Gordetsky writes all the jokes, you know. But like, I didn't feel like there was one that was like a road, like where the comedian was on the road and that's all they do is the road. So I just thought it made sense. And also it was a little slice out of my own life. It's easier to write, you know, that way.
When you have a guest on, how many, do you guys do 5 shows a week now?
Mm-hmm.
So when you have guests on, obviously they have movies and stuff and TV shows and stuff. Are you able to watch everything?
Yes, I do. And you know, the thing that I've learned, I mean, it's a, I'm going to do what you're doing.
Lean back with the microphone.
Well, here's what I've learned, and I'm putting this out there to like any of the young or old or middle-aged people that are thinking about getting into podcasting or any form that involves an interview. We've all done those radio tours where you talk to 32 TV stations in a morning, mm-hmm. or 32 radio stations from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. and whatever it is.
They're moderately soul crushing.
Right. And at the end, and you're talking to, you're going to markets you never heard of, cities that have no functioning government. Like, you're like, what? Like, what? There's what? There's a Good Morning where? DeKalb? Does anyone live in DeKalb, Illinois? You know, they have a Good Morning show, and you're doing it. And you realize, like, I always say, if you do like 36 stations, at the end, I'll always turn to the publicist or whoever booked it, and I'll go, I think 4 of those people saw the movie. Or maybe 4 of those people skim the book.
Right.
And they just don't do it. And then when you do The Tonight Show, Jay Leno comes down and he saw the movie.
Right.
And Jimmy Kimmel comes down and he saw the movie. Like, that's part of Jimmy Kimmel's homework.
Right.
He does it at that level. But the guy who's in market, you know, 457 can't find time in his busy non-day to watch your 84-minute comedy.
Right.
And you realize there's a reason why those guys are those guys, and then these guys are doing Good Morning DeKalb, and it drives me nuts.
Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Jay Leno's not doing The Tonight Show anymore. Did you know that he left?
Oh, yeah, I know.
I mean,
but I still call a trash can an ash can.
Oh, that's a very
I'm old school.
That's a grandpa thing to say. Yeah, the ash can.
Old ash can. Go down to the filling station, get some soda pop and some new tennis sneakers.
You know, maybe there was some maybe I should talk to you more about the movie off the podcast so I don't give anything away, but I did notice some interesting things about it, because there were certain times in the movie where of course you're rooting for you as the protagonist, but then other times you're like, well, he's such a sour piece of work that it's like, how many guys do you know that it's like, God, that guy's so funny, but then so sort of destructive, and I hate everything, and ever I should be this, and I should have that, and that person. I mean, there was sort of some of him where I felt like, oh, it's your fault because you have a bad attitude.
Yeah, I don't like movies generally where, you know, the bad guy's just evil for being evil. Like, you know, he's walking down the street and he passes a dog and he just kicks it.
Right.
You know, it's like, I like movies where if the guy kicks the dog is because he made 20 bucks and he's an evil enough guy to take 20 bucks to kick a dog, but like not just kick a dog.
Right.
Like, I hate the evil for just being evil's sake.
Right.
And I don't like good for just good's sake. Like because no one is that way. You know,
yeah.
People sort of have their good days and bad days and nuances, and they're caring. You know, my character's a douchebag to the nice perky blonde who's behind the counter at the hotel, but she doesn't know what went on the night before.
Right.
And what I'm dealing with,
right.
You know? And so like, hopefully the audience goes, well, he's being a douche to her, but we do have a context for it because he just got kind of stiffed at the club, you know, the night before. But I was trying to, like, it's a weird fine line where you're rooting for the guy, but you're not sure why. And then there's plenty of things that, like, probably make him human in there, which was fine with me. Like, he's a comedian, you know, he's fucked up.
And obviously there's a huge arc in the movie about the nature of the entertainment business and how it's nice to have something else to do that's not that, so that you don't go crazy.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly, you know, the people that are living and dying every day with the business, I feel bad for them. But also, what I was trying to convey that you were getting into was the fact that people... Somebody's yelling at someone outside.
There's literally just like dudes standing outside the window just arguing about stuff.
That's all right.
Oh, he just
people
walked
know.
Away.
That's how you know this.
I tell you, that is Adam Carolla.
Synthesized, yeah. The part where we all know people that are super, super funny but can't make a living or can't thrive or flourish in this town. Like, every comedian or professional writer or anybody you know who's successful in this business, if you ask them who are the three funniest guys you know, they would name three names that you never heard of.
Right.
And then they would explain that they're living at their in-laws' place and they're managing cabins right now that are like off the Ohio River. And you're like, why isn't, if he's funnier, and they would go, oh, he's funnier than me. But I always say that there's the sort of, because I like car related stuff, I always say it doesn't matter how much horsepower your engine has, because we all know guys with like a 500 horsepower engine, but they can't get it to the rear wheels. Like, they can't convert it into something, you know, like super funny engine, but no, the tires aren't turning. If they are, they're just burning out.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've said this a million times, that when you meet people, you're like, God, this guy's so funny. What's good? But then if you spend any amount of time with them, you start to see like, okay, they're self-destructive. Okay. Or they're kind of shitty to people, or
right.
They don't allow themselves. Like, there's something, you know, I'm not saying it's all their fault, but there are definitely personality, traits that if they were altered would probably work better in their favor.
Yes, they just can't get out of their own way. Like, they just can't not do whatever they're doing to themselves constantly.
Is that part of the package of being that funny, do you think, of being a little off your rocker?
I think part of these guys, there's a couple things, I think. I think a lot of it is like, comedically, they're like natural, like really gifted athletes who don't really have to practice as hard as everybody else. Like Jimmy Kimmel's a guy who's funny, but he's also a guy who treats it like he's the slowest, widest guy on the field.
Mm-hmm.
And then so he's going to just run routes long after everyone goes home from the practice facility. Like he's going to keep doing it.
Right.
He doesn't. And then there are other guys, I don't know, you know, Randy Moss, Terrell Owens. Like they're like, I'm 6'5". I have a 40-inch vertical leap. What am I doing practicing? I don't need to practice.
Right.
And these guys, I think there's a part of them that feel a little superior because they're really smart and they're really gifted, but they don't realize without the dance and without the practice and without the game and without the people in the room liking them, it just never goes anywhere. And then they get older and they get bitter and, you know, and they always do something like, and then what happens is, like guys like you and me who might be able to give them an opportunity give up on them at a certain point. Like we all know that guy where it's like, I set him up with this meeting, I told him what to do, and he just went in there and did something completely.
Or he didn't show up.
Yeah, I had a friend who's like, I was going out to Boston. He was like living with his in-laws in Boston. I was playing the House of Blues, and it's a big House of Blues, like 1,200-1,300 seats, and it was sold out. And he's like, can I open for you? And I was like, I never have anyone open for me, but cool if that's 12 less minutes I got to do or whatever. And he does a guitar act. And he's super talented and super funny. And I just saw him and I just said, Josh, here's your three songs. Do these three songs. They're always home runs. They're super funny. And he knows them like the back of his hand. And just go out there. But three. Four is too many. Just do the three. Goes out there. Proceeds to open with a song I've never heard that would... Now it's a four-song set, but this song is like an in-between song, so nobody knows if he's like an actual singer,
right.
Or he's just singing this. It's an ironic song,
okay,
that I would know is funny, but the audience
without the setup
and doesn't say anything, right, and just goes out there, and it's like, we just stood backstage. I just told you what to do, and you just went. But you were begging to open for me.
Right.
But mental note for me, next time I'm in the Boston area, you don't get to open.
Yeah. Did he pull it out?
No. I mean, the first song was super confusing to everyone because he went and sat down and everyone thought, oh, maybe Joan Baez's younger brother's out there singing about something. And then by the time he got to the third and fourth song, people were snickering, but they were trying to acclimate themselves. And then the whole thing was 4 minutes too long, and it's like, what did I just say?
Right.
And how many times are we gonna do this?
Yeah, but you know, like people have to find their own way, do their own thing, and sometimes, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just think there's Jay Moore gives an interesting speech in the movie, and he's really great in it. He's a good actor.
He's a really good actor. Like when you watch his face where he's trying to kind of break this news to me.
And it's that speech of, you know, your character going, but I'm funnier than everyone. And he's like, that has almost nothing to do with anything. And right. Your heart kind of breaks a little bit, but you're like, yeah, I guess maybe that's true, you know?
Yeah, I've always thought that, you know, Jay is one of these guys that's like kind of hurt by his own ability because he can do all the voices and the stand up and the sports talk radio and all this stuff. He gets, you know, if you wear too many hats in this business from a performance standpoint, it'd be like, well, you know, Michael Jackson is, you know, the king of pop, but he also he does some country western, and he also does some reggae. Like it's not going to help. Just keep doing pop and do more of it.
Right.
You know, Jay Moore is one of these guys that's like almost a little too talented for his own good. He can just kind of slip into anything and do whatever he does.
It kind of made me wish like someone would just go, oh, I'm going to put him in some weird indie drama and just show people, you know, just remind people what he's capable of, because he was really good. I'm like, God, I kind of want to see him act in something for longer.
Yeah, he is good, and I knew he'd be good, and I was trying to make his character, which is sort of like Jimmy Kimmel's character, or Jimmy Kimmel in real life, but I was trying to make him into somebody that was like a little douchey, but like tough love, but also kind of trying to help,
yeah,
like by just being truthful with his old pal, and also trying to give him a job.
Yeah.
That seemed insulting to me, but to him it was like, here's this is a good job. Why won't you take this job? You know? Yeah, I loved every time that scene, I see that scene, I just watch his face trying to, like, I can tell he doesn't want to do what he's about to do, but he's going to do it anyway.
Is there any of the dynamic, does it mirror any dynamic that you ever had with Jimmy?
No, I've always had a kind of relationship with Jimmy where there were times in my career where I was having more success than he was, and then there was a long time when he was having more success than me, but it never affected our relationship. How it affected me is other people constantly going like, oh man, geez, that's got to be rough, right, with Jimmy, you know, doing
you mean,
all this thing.
They're basically they're directing the emotion they want,
right,
to solicit,
right? And I'm
you
like,
got to be upset about it. I mean, tell me that you're not up. I'm
right.
Sure you're, well, if you're so sure, why are we even having this conversation?
But it's like, you know, it's like you're talking to, you know, it's like Alex Borstein is standing next to Uma Thurman and you're going, that's got to be rough, right, standing next to her all day. And like, Alex Borstein's happy, I'm using her as a shorter, squattier physique. And she's happy. And she's like, no, I'm doing my own thing. You know? And you're like, yeah, but I wish you were tall and blonde though, right? And like, no, I'm fine. I like doing what I do. And he likes to, and like, we're happy for each other. And by the way, it's nice to have friends that are really successful because they like buy beach houses in Cabo at celebrity auctions for way too much and then invite you to come out and hang out, you know, and build barns and throw, you know, Super Bowl parties with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. Like, I like it, you know, but the notion in the movie and in real life sometimes is that somehow I feel bad about it.
Right.
You know, like, oh man, that sucks. I wish he was in Tampa doing midday so I could feel better about myself, which is insane.
Yeah, and a lot of the time, you know, I find that people don't have a rational comparison chart in their head where you go, look, whether or not that guy had that show, that doesn't mean you'd have it. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't mean you were next. You know, it's like, it kind of reminds me of the same thing that people do. Like, if you hear, I don't know, if someone hears like, Emma Watson got married. They're like, oh man, she did? Fuck. She's off the market now. It's like,
yeah,
you aren't next in line.
Oh, yeah, all the girls are like, Clooney's married. And they snapped their pencil. All the chicks with the big arm fat just snapped their pencil. They're sitting at the temp job at the desk, you know. Damn it. He's off the market.
Son of a. So it.
He was going to eat my pussy this weekend. This weekend, we're going to Lake Como this weekend, so we're getting my pussy.
Lake Como is going to be Lake Como, but it's not anymore.
Damn it.
Not for me.
Yeah, no, see, the sad thing is the way people are wired is, it's not that they think, oh, you would have that job. It's just somebody you knew is having more success than you.
And it reminds,
and thus you must be angry or bitter at them.
Because the essentially the back of that other person is a mirror. And what
right.
people are seeing is, you know, oh, it's not happening. Like, it's reminding them that it's not happening. But I think I'm competitive in the way where I think there's a good, healthy way for competition to exist, which is, it's not that toxic, like, God damn it, if I can't, then no one. It's
right.
like, all right, that's great. Now I wonder, it just motivates me to work harder or motivates me to try something new or go, okay, well, that person's doing that, so I'll do this, or I'll, you know, I'll work longer hours to try to make this happen, as opposed to the thing that, of course, we have a tendency to do, which is, God damn it, oh man, I'd never, fuck everything, and then just, you know, light your career on fire.
The only time it ever does, like, the only time I ever feel like the little stitch in the rib is when, like, a week ago, maybe a week and a half ago, I get this, like, note from my assistant, and he's like, Entertainment Weekly wants to talk to you. And I'm like, finally, those guys are going to recognize what we've done. We've raised $1.5 million through crowdfunding. We made a funny movie, and finally we're going to get a little credit for it, because they never talk, you know, they'll do a story on like crowdfunding,
yeah,
but they'll just talk about everybody but me.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why, but that's just kind of the way it goes with them. And oh, I think I know. I mean, they've hated me for like since when the Man Show ended. They kind of went, well, now that Jimmy Kimmel's made his ill-fated trip into late night and Comedy Central's performed a Corolla-ectomy, we finally have two new hosts for the show, which pissed me off to no end, because Comedy Central never performed a Corolla-ectomy. But now Entertainment Weekly wants to talk, and I'm like, good. They want a story about crowdfunding and my new comedy Road Hard and blah blah blah. And it's like, they're doing a feature on Jimmy.
Yeah.
And they're talking to people from his, and I'm like, the timing was just fucking horrible for this one.
I know that stitch, because for the longest time it was always, you know, or at least early in my career, I guess maybe like 5 or 6 or 8 years into my career, it was always, you know, about Jenny.
Jenny McCarthy.
And
Jimmy McCarthy, the ultimate foe.
And we didn't have any, there was no toxicity between us or anything, but it did always kind of like, you know, and I think it was one of the things that motivated me to like, to focus and work hard and be like, because I don't like the way this feels. And I also see, I don't want to end up in a pit of misery and bitterness because I allowed myself to get overtaken by that. Because at a certain point in your, you know, at a certain point in your life, it's, you probably, you know, like if you're 65 and you've been bitter for 40 years, then you probably should think about something else.
Yeah, I had it for a while and sporadically with Jimmy and Dr. Drew.
Oh, that's right.
So it'd be like Rolling Stone wants to talk to you. And I'm like, ooh, Rolling Stone wants to do a feature on the podcast? They're doing a thing on Dr. Drew.
I'll tell you.
And then the next one would be, Wall Street Journal wants to talk. I'm like, oh, they're doing something on the movie? No, they want to talk about Jimmy.
for me, I noticed a paradigm shift in my career, and I actually took this as a huge, I took this as a win. When I started working for G4 in 2007, 2008, the "Did you fuck Jenny McCarthy?" question stopped, and then people started saying, "Did you fuck Olivia Munn?" Like, I was like, I've survived.
Wow.
There's a whole new other person that people are asking me about now. But this is, at least we've moved on.
I had a person. Nay.
The answer was no to both of those.
Oh, why couldn't you let me just enjoy that?
I'm so sorry.
A little bit longer.
I apologize. I didn't mean.
I had this witch from, like, I don't remember if it was Men's Health or Wall Street Journal or something, but she was doing a feature on Dr. Drew, and you know, she's going, you know, what's he really like, and how long you guys, and you know, is it true that blah blah blah. And at some point, this is about, God, it's like 6, 7 years ago, she goes, he's got 3 shows on TV. I go, yeah. Then she went, you don't have any. How does it make you feel?
Like, that sucks.
What the fuck kind of journalism is this?
Well, the problem with that kind of a question is that it's very leading.
Mm-hmm.
That she's that person's trying to elicit a certain response.
Yeah.
And so when you answered annoyed, it allows that person to fill out the narrative that they were leading you toward, and not like, I'm annoyed that you would say that to a person.
Yes, not that he has three shows that you're asking, that you're actually phrasing it. How does it make you feel?
Yeah.
Like, I thought we're just going to talk about his three shows and maybe we could get together and brainstorm on a fourth for him that he could, like, it's called Dr. Drew Sleeps. And we just put a nanny cam on him and just count how many times he rolls over. But she's like, how does that make you feel? It was like,
I just swiped your nuts with a cheese grater. Tell me, what are you feeling right now? I'm curious. How are you feeling?
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Oh,
I mean,
God.
It is not, how did you respond?
I wasn't douchey about it. I just like, you know, it's fine. Like I've never really, you know, for me, a couple, you know, everything is gravy for me. I'm way ahead of where I'm supposed to be in life. And then I was doing a syndicated morning show at the time and making plenty of money and like fine and wasn't. You know, it's just like bad driving. Like, I don't take it personally that the person just cut me off, like he has a vendetta or she has a vendetta against me. I'm just like more interested in the person. Like, I see child seats in the car. Like, is this how you drive all the time? Like, how do you get through life? Like, it's a little less like I don't really internalize it. I'm more like, how's this going for you? And how are you gonna, you know, join the cast of 60 Minutes with this shitty attitude of yours?
Yeah.
Good luck with Bono.
It definitely seems that a lot of people feel that everything that happens is a personal attack on them. And the truth is, it's, you know, and this should be a relief to people. 99% of the things in the world are not personal attacks on you. Like, they just, things happen. Other people are thinking of their own shit. They're not thinking about you. That, you know, they probably did something to inadvertently fuck you over while they were upset about being inadvertently fucked over themselves. It's just this weird human centipede of of misery.
No, I mean, look, even like terrorist attacks aren't personal. Like, it's just whoever's in the mall or in the airplane or wherever, you know, like they just need individuals, you know. I learned a long time ago, like age 9, like don't internalize whatever everyone else is doing. Like I remember one time in the very beginning, I went to like a Rite Aid or a Costco or I think it was a Rite Aid. It's like one of those Save-On, Rite Aid, whatever places. And I was with Jimmy. And I ran into a guy who was from my old troupe, like my Acme improv troupe. And he's maybe a couple years younger than me, nice looking. He was kind of like, oh, this guy's going to be the guy to break out. But I kind of broke out. I was all over MTV and everything at the time. And I ran into him and he's like, hey, man. I was like, oh, hey, man. And I introduced him to Jimmy or whatever, and he was like, what are you up to? What are you doing these days? And I'm like, oh, I'm doing a radio show and doing a show on MTV. And he's like, oh, well, good for you. And had a little exchange and then went our separate ways. And we're walking out, Jimmy is like, oh, that guy, he knows what you do. He saw you on TV. He knows you're on MTV. He knows about Loveline. Like, he didn't want to give it up.
He was posturing.
And I was like, oh, you think so? And he was like, oh, definitely. And I was like, oh, I didn't know where. I just had it completely at face value. And I don't know who was right in this equation. But the point is like, it didn't bother me. And I didn't read into it. I just assume he didn't have basic cable.
Yeah.
Or whatever. He didn't stay up at night and listen to the radio. Or, like, I never thought for a second that.
Because that's not a tactic that you would employ ever, so it wouldn't occur to
you. Right. I wouldn't do it to somebody else, so I wouldn't think it would happen to me. But it is one of those things where either it's happening or it's not happening, and we'll never know if that's what he was doing or not doing. But why not just take the path where you assume that he didn't know and that he's not being sort of spiteful and petty and what have you, and then just go about your way. Like, why assume, you know, it's like every time you go to a restaurant, you could just assume that whoever's cooking your food shot a snot rocket into it. But
right.
Or you could never think about it and just enjoy your meal.
Yeah. And the truth is almost irrelevant.
It really is.
You're not going to know. And it's probably much better. It's a good metaphor. It's much better to assume that life is not shooting snot rockets into your pot roast.
And if you order things like nachos, it's actually better for you with the snot rocket.
Yeah, it helps a little
bit. It's healthier. It helps a little protein.
The consistency of the cheese. It mixes in there. You think it's jalapeno. It's fine.
Just from a pure, like if your doctor had a choice, would he rather Chris eat nachos with or without snot rockets? He'd probably say, just from a pure health standpoint, yes.
I don't know. Even from a pure health standpoint, I'm not sure the math checks out on that, Adam. I'm not 100% sure that it does.
I work with Dr.
Okay.
Drew.
For all right,
you
listen.
Work with Jenny McCarthy. I know she's your own kind of physician.
One of our partners was for vaccinations. That's all we know.
That's right.
But I want to talk about the crowdfunding because it's – did you have any – obviously you raised $1.5 million, so that's a huge thing. But it – did anyone give you any shit along the way? Because there is this sort of like, I think people will probably assume, oh, you probably got millions of dollars. Why don't you just pay for it yourself? Why you gotta go out there and make people give you money for it? You know, and my answer to that with that kind of stuff, and I haven't crowdfunded anything yet, but I've had friends who have, and I kind of go like, you know, the people who donate money are grown-ups and they can decide what they want to give their money to, and it's not, you know, you're not forcing anyone to do anything.
Well, you know, I have a couple answers. One is, yeah, you're right. Look, whenever the Rolling Stones or Lady Gaga or whoever comes into town, they don't force you to buy a ticket. You
right.
can go if you'd like. And then, by the way, there's one where you get to sit up in the nosebleed seats that costs $63. And then there's one that's $3,500 where you get to sit against the stage. You know, I mean, you decide.
Yeah.
And anywhere in between or don't go at all.
Right.
My answers are fewfold. One is I could definitely sell some stuff and make a movie, but it's not really it's not an endeavor where you make your money back.
Right.
So you'd be pretty foolhardy as a parent of twins to just like get a second mortgage on the house or just start liquidating assets to make a movie where you're never really going to get a return on right. your investment. So
no one really pays like the movie business, like no one really pays for their own. It's not, you know,
yeah, they don't, no one pays for their own movie because no one really ever makes any money. I mean, every once in a while you get My Big Fat Greek Wedding, but Little Miss Sunshine or whatever, Transformers, that's a different story, but nobody really, you don't get your money back.
Now, what are the mechanics of how the money works in a movie? So this movie's out on iTunes now. I mean, I bought it on iTunes.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did.
I thought we sent it.
You did, but I wanted to support it.
Oh, God damn, you're a good human being.
I didn't even rent it. I bought it.
You're a lot better than I am, Chris Hardwick. A lot. God damn it, I'm jealous of Hardwick now. Now I got Kimmel and Hardwick and Drew.
I'm going to pay someone.
Think she's morally superior to me?
I'm going to pay someone to pretend they're from some type of a news outlet to call and ask you a question about me. But I... I'm kind of wondering, you know, saying, well, you'll never make that money back. You know, where does money go? How does it? I mean, I just don't understand.
Okay. Well, I'll break it down for you. So first off, people buy everything from Adam goes to your nice house in the Palisades and does stand up in your living room on your 40th birthday with you and your drunken friends.
Yeah.
You know, that's one. Two, everyone, you know, 10 people go to Phil Rosenthal's house 2 miles from here, and we have pizza and mangria, my drink, and watch it with Phil at his house in mm-hmm. his home theater. He's the guy from Everyone Loves Raymond, or he's the guy who is the creator of that show. So the packages, or they just go, you get a Blu-ray and a T-shirt,
mm-hmm.
you know. So they go from 20 or 25 bucks up to 15 grand, depending
right.
on what we're doing. And right now it's pay the fiddler time. So I just got back from New York and Minneapolis and Chicago and DC, and tomorrow it's San Francisco, and then it's Portland and Seattle, because those people paid
right
to watch the movie with me, and
so
then do a
Q&A.
Right. They paid, they bought a ticket for a movie that didn't exist 2 years ago.
Right.
So there's all the fulfillment stuff that goes on, and then all the inevitable, hey man, I ordered an extra large, and then the fat guy takes a picture of himself with his gut hanging out in it, and he goes, does this look like an extra large? And then he tweets it to you,
right,
you know, hashtag blow yourself, and it's like, all right, sorry, somebody sent out the wrong, you know, and people move, and people are like, I bought a screening to the
He's
LA
He's personalizing
thing,
it in that case.
Yeah,
it's not perfect.
Right. So there's all the fulfillment.
Right.
So it's and I don't have the exact breakdown of this, but if you get $1.5 million, you better set aside $150,000 to fulfill.
Sure.
Like Blu-rays and posters and signposters.
That's a
and
good
t-shirts
note, actually.
Set aside, and then the person and people who have to do this times 14,000.
Mm-hmm.
There's 14,000 people that were all promised something, some better than others. But there's going to be a dude who, when I blow through, I was in Chicago on Saturday. And if I don't have dinner with that dude who paid thousands of dollars, and not, you know, $20,000, but I don't know, $4,000 or $5,000. If I miss that dude in Chicago, we're going to pretty pissed off camper.
Right.
Who gave $5,000 2 years ago, and now I blow through Chicago, and I'm like, oh, I missed him, or I don't
right
have time, or he got his email got lost, or something like that. So there's a very kind of heavy commitment on the, you got 14,000 potentially, like,
investors
that could be pissed. So
right,
let's make them happy. Now, as far as the business goes, you put it up on iTunes and video on demand and blah, blah, blah. You know, you open in like 11 theaters or whatever. You spend X amount on, you know, what they call P&A, just advertising and stuff, just to let people know, hey, it's at this theater. It's at the Sunset Lemley 5 or whatever, which is where I'm heading after this, but to fulfill more stuff. But, you know, the theaters, like, you whatever you made that weekend, you get half of it.
Okay.
So you split it with whoever owns the theater. And by the time you end up covering the advertising and whatever you put into getting people into that theater, you basically just kind of break even on the theater. It's kind of a wash, but you do it to say we had a theatrical release,
right,
and then when Showtime or HBO or, you know, Comedy Central comes calling, you can say, well, we had a limited theatrical release. So that's almost just doing it for the sake of saying you're doing
right
it. When it comes to like Xbox and, you know, and Amazon and all that kind of stuff, it comes in like dribs and drabs, you know, a few grand here and a few grand there. And it just takes place. It's not like an avalanche opening weekend, floodgates, money comes pouring in. But it's the kind of thing where you think, well, if you can get a good enough word of mouth and you can get enough people like you, and you tell your audience and your audience goes to Amazon and they see it and they like it, or they go to iTunes and they see it and they like it, and they tell a couple of friends, maybe at some point you get back to even. But it's really more of like a vanity thing than it is a business, you know?
Yeah, you really, what I'm learning about the film business is that in most cases, unless, you know, unless it's a fluke, unless it's like, you know, Paranormal Activity,
right,
it costs
right
nothing, and it got, you know, you have to spend a lot of money to make a lot of money. You have to spend millions of dollars to then make millions of dollars.
I literally, like, 50,000 independent films come out a year, and you've heard of Paranormal Activity.
Yeah.
And that's about it. Like, that's the game. And you don't make any money and you don't get anything. I swear to God, for me, literally, and then you spend all your time writing it and like phoning in all the favors and trying to get Bryan Cranston to do the crowdfunding video and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, I saw
he's in a poster in the background in one of the scenes.
Yeah, trying to get Bryan Cranston, who's in New Orleans, to do a quick little photo shoot so we can, you know, do a thing, you know, do a green screeny thing where we slide him in with my kids and make a stupid sitcom that's in a poster behind the whatever. Like, everything from like designing the poster to sitting in a windowless room and cutting the trailer to cutting the movie, like so many, to the post, like all the mixing and the color correction, everything. It's just one huge time suck. And then once in a blue moon, this happened with my last movie, The Hammer. You're just at some party or something, like Helen Hunt will come up and you'll go, oh, look, that's Helen Hunt. I've never even met Helen Hunt. Like, I don't know. What are we going to talk about? And then she'll like come up and go, I really enjoyed your movie.
Oh,
and
crazy.
I go, what? And she'll go, I really enjoyed your movie. And I go, how did you see my movie? And then she goes, I went to the theater with my boyfriend. We both really liked it. I'm like, what are you doing?
You almost want to be ready. We're like, what? You're Helen Hunt.
You can't
be going to movie theaters to see my tiny independent film.
You better pray it was a matinee, bitch, because I'm fucking.
Don't you tell anyone. Don't you tell anyone what you did.
Yeah, like, what? Like, okay. And then at some point, years on, you interview Judd Apatow and he's like, I watch it with my wife, we loved it, you know. And you're like, all right, well, I'm now paid back. That's really all the payback
feel good points
you ever get, is you get like three of those.
So is the goal to basically just stay afloat to keep making movies, or do you want the movies to scale bigger and bigger and bigger, or do you want to do more acting?
I have no thoughts about it. I have one movie, The Hammer, that it was the only guy I didn't get paid and did all the work that had investors and they got paid back. And so far there's this movie where I'm the only one who hasn't been paid, but at least we don't have a bunch of investors to pay back. And the bottom line, I think with this whole, you know, crowdfunding stuff as it pertains to, you know, art, you know, I don't think it's this way for inventions or, you know, these guys that are looking for money to, you know, make a, you know, a robotic arm that works in a zero gravity environment, mm-hmm. or something. But for
we
the
should
ones,
write that down. That's a good idea, actually.
The ones that are making music or films or art of any kind, it's really all about trust. Like, I really think that a lot of all the person that cuts you a check for $25 or $125 or whatever it is, whether you're writing a book or making a painting or making a movie, is they're handing it to you going, now I'm trusting you not to fuck this up. If you make a piece of shit painting or piece of shit movie, I'm going to feel like I just funded a piece of shit.
Right.
So I think, I wasn't thinking about it much at the time, but I think the fact that I made a movie that people liked helped make this movie.
Sure.
And I've always said, you know, they're like, oh, you're going to crowdfund your next one, or how's this going to go? And I said, if people respond to this movie and feel like, and, you know, I read the tweets like, hey, gave the $25. Nice job. Feel good about myself. That's all they want. You know, they don't need any more than I trusted you and you didn't fuck me.
Right.
That's all they want. And if the response to this movie continues is positively with the fans and the people who paid for it as it does, then I imagine 4 years from now or whenever I can say to the same group, you want another movie? Because it's really like saying, I'm not going to make another movie because I don't have $1 million in 6 months lying around.
Right.
But if you would like to see me make another movie, then put down $30. I'll promise you a T-shirt, and I'll get to work on the next one.
They're almost kind of puppeting you a little bit, which is fun.
Yeah, and I do think, and it's kind of, you know, in a weird way, it's kind of condescending to go like, oh, so you're just going to get everyone to pay for your movie? Like, these people feel like they're the reason the movie exists.
Yeah.
And it's true. There's 14,000 very special individuals, but it's the movie exists because of them, and they like it, and they come to see the movie, and they go, that's
part
of me.
Yeah.
Right.
So as someone who has donated to Indiegogo, Kickstarter, you know, crowdfunding, I know that number one, it is nice to feel like, oh, I'm a part of this thing. I'm a part of this thing that was built. And I also know that there are people that I enjoy that I feel like I've gotten entertainment from over the years or whatever it is. And I kind of just feel like, hey, I just want to throw something back your way, you know, like, because I think people do inherently kind of like a balance. And I think if you feel like, hey, you know, I kind of get this free thing all the time, and, it, you know, like, if I get the opportunity, I'll throw something back, because then that kind of makes it even.
Right.
Hey, you give me this thing, I'm going to give you this, because I feel like that just feels like I need to do that. And I'm not saying that as in a way to guilt anyone or make them feel like they have to give anything at all. But for some people, they kind of just like to go, hey, you know, you bought dinner that one time, so I'm gonna do that this time. I just want to even the score, you know. So people do like feeling that they're throwing something back your way if they feel like they've gotten free entertainment or whatever.
And there's also just a kind of, I mean, to take that thought and detour it a little, but same county, maybe different road. Feel like they're a part of something and invested in something. Like when Dr. Drew and I used to tour the country all the time, we played colleges, you know, and some of the colleges were free for the students, and then some were, you know, they charge, I don't know, $15 or whatever it was to come see us. But I would always like kind of tell the promoter, at least charge $1, because they need to feel like they gave something.
They're invested
and then
in the
came
show
and did whatever, because the freebie audience is like the ones that are checking their watch about 45 minutes in and going, well, I don't need to, like, how it's like when once in a while when you go to a free movie or screener or whatever, it's
there's
so much
nothing
easier.
At stake.
It's so much easier to get up and go, I'm not captivated.
Yeah, that's why a papered room in a comedy club can be bad sometimes, because it's like they're not invested in any way. And it's like, I don't give a shit. I was just going to sit at home and
put
a finger in my butt.
My whole take on the whole thing was, you know, I wasn't going to reinvent anything. I was just going to give it a try. I had no idea what to expect when we started, but I did do the advice I guess I would have for the people who are thinking about this is, when you do the crowdfunding stuff, you put together like a four and a half minute video that's like, oh, here's what we're asking for.
Right.
Here's what we're doing. You know, I imagine if it's a young 11-year-old girl who sings and is looking to make an album or a demo or something, we need to hear her sing a little bit.
Right.
Otherwise, we don't know what we're getting involved with here. So the one thing that I thought I think was smart on my behalf is I realized, like, if I can't put together a really funny 4 minutes, how are they going to trust me with 94 minutes?
Because that would be a test right there.
Yeah, it's like they just had the little sampler of the summer sausage in front of the Hickory Farms, and they're spitting it out.
Right.
I can't get them to buy the huge kielbasa
log. You're not going to move the sausage that way.
Right. So I started like thinking like, and everyone else would do this thing where it was like, Here's who's in my movie. Oh, here's who just dropped by. Here's what we're doing. Here's all the stuff that the movie's about. And here's the theme. And here's what's going on. And I just thought, get Cranston in there and have him just swear that he'd never be involved with this process at all. And it'd be funny. And people wouldn't know what the fuck the movie was about. But at least they'd know something funny was going on. That was my whole plan, and I think I should give Cranston definitely some credit for being pretty menschy and helping me out with that.
Cranston gets enough credit. that guy. He got Breaking Bad. I was next in line.
Yeah, yeah. If only he would have gotten into a motorcycle accident earlier that week, I could have been Walter White.
No, I could have been Jesse, but I don't think I would have been a good job.
You could have been a good Jesse.
But yeah, Cranston's the best. He's such a sweetheart.
Literally, he said to me when I was like, we'll come to you. Do you have just an hour just to knock this thing out? And he kind of went like, he was in New Mexico. And he said, well, I'm going to Toronto to shoot a movie about a lizard, but that's exactly what he said.
But I guess.
But I am going to be home for like 2 days in between, you know, New Mexico and going to Toronto. And I'm sure the last thing he wanted to do was talk to me about my crowdfunding video. But God bless him.
So it is now, it is not in podcasting time, but in actual time, it is 7:01, and I'm told that you have to go to fulfill one of these 14,000 rewards at the Lemley Sunset
I
5.
I probably have about 5 more minutes. You don't have to.
Okay.
You don't have to card out.
I just got a note from Katie Levine that said Adam has to rap.
No,
Katie Levine, of course, brought to us by the Ace Broadcasting Network.
She's a sweetheart and missed daily. But yeah, I can get to the Sunset 5 in, you know, 11-12 minutes from here.
Yeah, so. You'll be okay. Have you talked at all about, and we can cut this out if you want to bring it, stew it up, but the sort of winning the podcast patent stuff? Because when last time you were on.
I mean, it's like thank you and thank everyone who circled the wagons and got involved with this patent troll thing. The kind of long and the short of it is they pick on big corporations that don't really have microphones, you know, and picking on guys with microphones was probably an ill-fated choice for them because they didn't want a whole bunch of, you know, they kind of work in the shadows,
right?
And they didn't need us, the community. And I'm not just saying me, I mean, you and, you know, Mark Maron, Joe Rogan, like all the people. They didn't need that kind of publicity. They don't want any kind of publicity. They just want to quietly go about their day suing people with super deep pockets and then go golf. So when we all kind of band together and started bitching about it, they didn't like all the noise. And they started with it's always funny. Like I'm always curious about those people who just like, you're just standing there eating an ice cream cone and they just come up and kick you in the knee. They just, you know, just kick you right in the shin. And then you punch them in the arm and they go, what the fuck?
Right.
And they're like, hey man, enough with all the trash talk. And I'm like, well, you did sue us.
For a bullshit reason.
Right. So you have to expect a certain amount of trash talk. But they basically, they got tired of hearing me and us talk shit about them. And they basically, you know, several $100,000 into the ordeal said, you know what? We're going to be nice guys and just go away.
Oh, how nice.
So that was sweet. And there's a hand, I don't have all the paperwork in front of me, but there's a handful of people that were sort of indemnified. But in general, the notion, what happened was, is they came scratching around podcasting. Like they're a group of guys that just try to sniff out, you know, they're like a dog that sniffs nickels.
Right.
You know, like, where, come on, boy, where are they? Where are they? Where are they? Where are they? You know, so somebody over there saw a couple rolls of nickels over in the podcast bush, you know, and went like, hey, what do you got over there, boy? Someone's doing something over there? Some money being made over there? What's going on over there? Hey, I've heard of this. I've heard of that guy. Let's go over there and stick around. And then they came around and they put their snout in our ivy and they basically got bit by a rattlesnake and now they're just going back over to back to Sony, back to iTunes, back to whatever, and it went. Like I don't expect them coming back to the podcast community for anything because A, they don't see any nickels in it, and B, everyone's got a microphone.
Yeah. I would say it's probably less like a rattlesnake was in the bushes and like 25 macaws. You know, just like
yeah.
screeching all at once.
Super, super, super loud blue parrots. I don't
know. God damn, they won't shut up.
No, you're right. You're right. Not a rattlesnake, because a rattlesnake is silent and noble in its
and
own
deadly
way.
And deadly in the podcast.
We're just
like,
a bunch of... occasionally, it's like a feather flying around. I said... Yeah, that's just weird. You're like flapping the wings.
Flapping. Jesus yeah. Christ, I can't even hold this thing. Jesus, yeah. fucking throw it.
Oh, it's shitting on me. It's shitting.
Damn it.
It's shitting.
I got a beak in the face. Oh, man, that's going to get infected.
I said, I don't know why. It always makes me laugh, but when I was doing my morning show with Danny Bonaducci, I called my agent at some point.
Such an interesting sentence.
No, and I was like, I can't take it anymore. I mean, the guy smells of Marlboros and Axe, and he's doing chin-ups with his shirt off, and he's cowboy boots and New Religion jeans and all this kind of stuff every morning. It's like, I can't take it anymore. Like, I can't take it. And I did like Danny. Like, he's a likable guy and a great guest. It's just I didn't want to do a show with him every day, you right. know? And my agent, Baby Doll, who's yeah. Represented in the movie.
Larry Miller.
Larry Miller is great. Another really good actor. My agent just said, baby, just ignore him. And I said, what if I just let a macaw loose in your house and just said, move on? And sometimes it'd be like 4 a.m. and you'd open the bathroom door to take a piss and flick the light on and the macaw wouldn't be there. And then other times it'd be flapping in your face.
Right. In like, True Religion jeans.
Could you just ignore that macaw? You'd open a kitchen cupboard and be standing there. Flapping around.
No, stop doing chin-ups.
Right.
It's weird to see your feathered arm.
Just ignore your radio partner. That's good. That's a great, that's what you call chemistry.
Yep. Don't even.
Just pretend he doesn't exist.
When he says something, you just say another thing. That's just,
or don't stop talking. Just keep
just
going.
Barrel through.
Just push on through. Soldier on. Just spoken like a true agent who lives 3,000 miles away and just wants that paycheck to keep coming in.
Yeah.
Like, baby, just ignore him. Move on.
I mean, if I don't have to worry about it, you don't have to worry about it. You're even near the situation.
Yeah. I'm living across the street from the old Baldwin house in Massapequa.
You live in a castle chiseled out of gold.
You're not,
the walls are thick. You're not hearing anything.
Yeah, I think he'd tell John Stewart to just ignore it. I don't think so.
All right, so Road Hard is the movie, and it's available. I saw it on iTunes.
God,
I got it on
love
iTunes.
You.
And people should see it. It is probably the most accurate representation I've seen of life on the road as a comic, and also the audition process, which is, you know, for people who are like, you know, it's not like you're building the bridge or having to lift rebar all day. It's like, yeah, no, it's not. But it's a different, there's a certain amount of just like having your soul squeezed a little bit when people talk down to you in a room. They're like, perform.
Well, the thing, I'll give away a little joke because it's just an inside joke, but every time you go to an audition, there's like six people sitting across and four of them don't need to be there, but they always put a chair across the table. And then when you walk in and sit down, they go, oh, you're going to sit?
You're going to sit down?
And you're like, well, why'd you put the... what you called me into a room and you put a chair in the middle of the room.
And they're a little snippy. Okay, well, no one else. But that's fine.
Right.
Because really what you need in that situation is someone being condescending to you when you're trying to focus in this very artificial environment.
I could solve this problem right now. Don't put the chair in the middle of the room if and you don't want the person to sit in it. That would solve this right away, but they always
every
always
time.
That. Thanks, buddy. I'm really glad you saw
no,
it.
No, man. Good to see you, Adam, and congratulations on the movie, and good luck fulfilling your 14,000 obligations.
Thanks.
Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think, some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondry and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondry app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondry Plus in the Wondry app or Wondry Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Once Upon a Beat.